You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Joyce Carol Oates, the author most recently of Foxfire, Confessions of a Girl Gang, published by Dutton. Also recently published is an anthology of her selected early stories called Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? From the Ontario Review Press. And I wanted to talk about the books together because Foxfire is very much a novel of girlhood, young womanhood. And it seemed as if gathering up your early stories may have crystallized this novel, or Foxfire may have crystallized the gathering. I wondered if there was a sort of return.
I think probably there was a kind of confluence of motives there. When we look back upon our earlier lives, it's amazing the wisdom that perspective can give us. And certain themes seem to recur that at the time were felt almost invisibly. But looking back, I think you're quite right. Putting these things together had that effect upon me.
We've spoken before of the sense that your books group themselves into clusters, and I found myself thinking that Black Water, which is dedicated to all the Kellys, it's a book that takes its inspiration from the tragedy at Chautauqua, that book was the voice of a victim rising out of the water, and here Foxfire is the voice of previous victims turned aggressors, turned revengers. And I began to wonder if you're working on a revenge cycle.
Probably I was working with the idea of women, women's voices and girls' voices, who in the real world, apart from books, are mute and have no voice. It wasn't that I was thinking of revenge so much, because Kelly as a performer, so to speak, in Blackwater never gets any revenge and doesn't even think of revenge. She forgives the senator. But I think you might mean more generally speaking,
more general,
as the author.
A kind of arc of
the authorial revenge. That may be. I wasn't aware of it.
Because I remember, you know, Kelly seemed to me to be a further examination of the woman in Do With Me What You Will, where certain levels of extreme passivity, almost as if their function, at least in that book, had been to be a mirror, to be unperturbed, to be behind glass. In Black Water, it seemed to be the surface of the water that, in a way, protects her. And this seems to be Foxfire, a book, I guess, fairly obviously, that seems to mirror, at least in the sound, the title Black Water, Foxfire, to be all of these women rising up to protect women.
Yes, that's true. I also wanted to write about those very intense feelings of friendship that young adolescent girls feel. I'm not sure what adolescent boys feel at all. It may be something very different, but girls have these intense feelings as if the whole world is to be excluded. And its passion, I suppose, is a tinge of eroticism to it. But it's not a novel about lesbians. It's just that they have these very, very powerful feelings. That was part of the motive of the novel. And then it's as if girls' voices are in a kind of chorus speaking of these experiences.
What I loved is that some of the events, I guess the only other versions of this novel, well, you know, for women, tend to be movies like Reform School Girl.
And yes, so yes.
There's a
which I've never seen.
But it's you know, again, the strange, you know, one feels, even watching it, that it's very male. In fact, one suspects that the writer of that movie was thinking of boys when he thinks of the girl who intentionally throws the baseball bat and knocks one of her prison sisters out. You think, oh, no, this happened in juvenile hall, but among men. Mm-hmm. Here, it's as if these sort of sordid events that come from all sorts of imaginative places, some of them seem to be from prison movies, from gang books, from autograph albums and movie magazines. You know, a lot of the prose here has the intensity of the things you find in high school autograph albums with people pledging to one another
one
forever.
Love, yes.
Yeah. And what I loved most was the invention of an author's voice. A girl named Maddie Wirtz, well, she's a woman now, narrates the book, but she narrates it from her old journals. And so the book is written by someone who once wanted to be and hasn't become a writer.
Yes, that's more or less so. She's become an astronomer's assistant. She has a kind of visionary heart. She's projected her spiritual longings up into the night sky, almost literally, and has become an astronomer's assistant. And that makes her different from the girls of her background. She may have wanted to be a writer, but somehow we see that that didn't quite work out. She was the one who, in any case, was the most verbal of all the other girls. And most of the other girls could not sit still for 5 minutes to read a book, let alone try to write. And you're quite right, finding the author's voice, the author within the book, that was the great challenge for me, and that took quite a while before I got what I thought was the right cadence.
Well, what I'm interested by, we've again spoken before about the shifting of identities and their mutation in your work. It seems here like Maddie Wirtz would have grown up to be Joyce Carol Oates, but she does not, clearly.
She might have.
Might have. And it's that might have, not the portrait of the artist as a young woman, but the portrait of a would-be artist as a young woman.
Very interesting.
It seemed fascinating to me. And you hear what it is in her narrative voice that will not make her a writer. The passion is there, but something about dropped stitches, a querulousness, an unwilling to witness the climax of events, a refusal to imagine beyond a certain point, seems to be, you know, what makes her finally an assistant stargazer.
Well, that's very interesting, Michael. I hadn't thought of that myself. Of course, you do come up with these amazing revelations, which is why conversing with you is so wonderful. I suppose that's so. She's on a path. She is going to transcend her world, but her path takes her by way of the so-called objectivity of science rather than the subjectivity of art.
But she also specializes in measuring the distance between things.
Yes.
Which seems to be her thematic here throughout the book, is the distance of these events in the past and memory.
Yes. And just the wonder of trying to understand them. The extraordinary wonder when you try to understand almost the least little thing that has happened to you in your life, let alone certain profound things, assuming that 3 or 4 or 5 profound things have happened to us before the age of 15, just contemplating what they are and how they change us irrevocably.
Well, it also interested me that these the gang's firebrand is Legs Sadovsky, who has herself led many mysterious lives. She seems, in the pages past the end of the book, to be found among the Fidelistas in Cuba. But even before that, she appears with mysterious amounts of money to buy everyone presents. She's known by very religious sisters who remember her after she's disappeared. She befriends an alcoholic priest in the park. And like her, Maddie, too, has a side that seems to come from elsewhere. She reports that she doesn't know what truth is, and doesn't know how to notate it. There's a sort of metaphysical dimension that has entered the narrative heart here that seems to, of course, make the book not about something other than a girl gang, but to have a kind of thematic nimbus of other things across it.
Yes, that's right. She begins in the first chapter by talking about how they all were from Hammond, New York, which is a fictitious analog of Lockport, New York, and how they all seem very different to one another, and yet seen from a distance or from by way of a stranger, they might all sound alike. They might all seem alike as if they were sisters. And that's a strange fact of identity, too, that we seem to one another very different, but then to strangers we look as if there's a kinship.
Well, you know, the lighting in this book, I thought of those photographs, sometimes postcards, that you see often the Pegasus on the Texaco sign appears.
Yes, that's wonderful.
And,
yes.
You know, the look of a gas station with that mythological horse above it,
yes,
and the garish blues and reds seem to be the colors of this book. And also Legs, who's first seen running across rooftops, seems always about to ascend.
That's right.
And I thought really as if her creation was sort of like a vindication of Faulkner's Temple Drake, who's also always seen running. But he won't let her triumph.
No,
she has
no,
to be raped.
Not.
This woman, you know, escapes and climbs the sides of water towers and, you know, is capable of anything.
She does all the things that men supposedly can do. But then she's very reckless also, and it takes her too far. It's as if she's absorbed some of the attributes of maleness. She's putting on this strange cloak of maleness, and it's almost a fantasy maleness, and ultimately it leads to her destruction.
There's been always, I don't know, I mean, popular culture calls them bad girls, you know, who look out from the window of the Detroit House of Women's Detention in you. And I wondered, I think more than any other writer, you've been drawn to delinquents of different kinds, other things as well, you know, musicians and prodigies. But I wondered, in terms of Foxfire, the attraction to the group antisocial.
Well, it's very strange, Michael. I'm a very anti-authority person, but the irony is, of course, that I'm a professor. You know, I've become part of the authority, and what I would be perceived as part of the establishment. Yet I really distrust and am highly skeptical of authority. There's almost a kind of adrenaline surge in me at the thought of, say, the Pope giving his blessing. You know, I feel that there's something so hypocritical about most figures of authority. I hope that I'm not one myself. I try to be very low-keyed and very realistic in my dealings with my students. But you're quite right, I have a real sympathy with the irreverent.
Where does it come from?
Maybe it's just natural in everybody. Maybe we all have it, but in some people it gets a bit stifled.
Well, no, because, you see, I think the first time I fell in love with something of yours, with someone of yours, it was Meredith Daw back
oh, yes.
in Do With Me What You Will. And
the radiantly mad Meredith Daw.
But, you know, and then I started, you know, seeing them in Parade, The Prophet, in Angel of Light. A real love, I guess I would call it, with perhaps presumption, for the person you never were but might have been.
Oh, that's true. What Yeats called the anti-self, very much. That's true, a real sympathy. And maybe a feeling almost of apology in terms of my own social role, that I become a person, as I said before, who seems to be part of the establishment.
Do you feel comfortable there?
I do and I don't. It's a complex and ambivalent feeling. It's really very hard to. I feel as if I'm exposing my heart very suddenly. I hadn't meant to start talking about things like this, but I do have a naturally rebellious streak, and I'm very deeply skeptical. At the same time, like all writers and all so-called creative artists, I'm very idealistic and romantic too. One really can't be a writer without being extremely romantic and almost to the point of self-delusion.
Well, I had wondered about that because, you know, you've been to the boxing ring and you've owned horses and there have been, well, at least a horse, and many worlds, racing, car racing, open up in your books. But the most constricted, to me, seemed to be the one in Hungry Ghosts, where you were writing about teachers and academics.
True, very true.
And it seemed to me to be one of the most punishing and least sympathetic books. I guess I ask this because, you know, I myself could have so easily been a teacher, and it was something I turned my back on.
Oh, you're not a teacher.
Oh, I would not. It just seemed to me to be a very frightening thing to become, you know. Very limiting thing.
It depends on the context. I mean, you'd be a wonderful teacher, actually, but with your love of books, you would communicate that enthusiasm. I think it'd be wonderful in the right context.
I was, you know, always afraid of, you know, the world, you know, shutting in on you.
Well, the bureaucracy of it is, as you say, shutting in and constrictive. But meeting with students who are motivated and who love to read and who have a kind of hunger for what you might tell them is actually one of the most wonderful experiences that one can have.
You don't teach writing, do you?
I do teach writing, but I also teach literature at Princeton University. We'll have a big anthology, and we'll be doing Faulkner and James Joyce and Tolstoy and Chekhov. So we're doing what might be called real literature side by side with the students' work, and the students can look at their own work and look at the classics and see the distance between, the abyss between. And much of teaching writing has to do with imbuing students with a sense of how wonderful literature is, that they learn how to read the classics very carefully. Where in the past they might have simply read Faulkner, now they look at the craft and they see how his genius flourishes. So it can be a very rewarding experience.
I wanted to ask you about Foxfire as well. In its title, I guess, you know, Foxfire is a light that goes out. And built into the structure of the book is the fact that this gang, like some constellation that gets dispersed, is destined to drift away from one another. I wondered whether novels are like that, a coalescence of characters and perceptions that don't outlast their occasion.
Well, that's true. They linger in the memory, like dreams imperfectly recalled, and yet they're not communicable to anybody else. They're rapidly fading or retrievable only in dreams. But at the time you're working on a novel, these characters are so vividly alive. They really are like upright flames. It's an interesting analogy. But a novel has a certain afterlife in the life of the writer, and it continues for quite a while, sometimes, in fact, for decades, to the writer.
I guess I was talking to Paul West recently, and he had begun to name books that of his own, that he felt lived for him, that if he were asked to give permission for only five of his books to remain in print, that he knew which they would be. Mm-hmm. Do you have books like that that have stayed favorites for you?
I'd have to think about it. Writers are notoriously close to the most recent work, so sometimes one is blinded, because the recent work needs your heart's blood to keep it going. It's like your organs have been pumping life into this recent work. Then after a period of time, I think we can gain perspective. But I would point to my novel Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, and You Must Remember This, and Them. But then I've written many short stories I feel very close to.
I remember Jerry Mazzaro, a mutual friend, once told me, I'd asked him, it was before I'd met you, and he said that you felt, I don't know if he was actually quoting you or just claiming to, that you felt like Auden, that one's best work rose to the surface, and that the other, that one didn't have to make a choice like this.
Well, that's probably true. I think Picasso has said this, and D.H. Lawrence, and maybe anyone who's been somewhat prolific. In fact, I think it was Picasso who said that it's not up to him to make any aesthetic assessment of his work, that belongs to other people. It's his role to create the work. I don't feel quite that detached from the critical function myself, because there are novels that do linger in my memory very, very powerfully. Who knows why? Paul West is an example of a writer's writer, and his work, I would say, is a phenomenon of language. He may not feel that way, but I would find it impossible to extricate a Paul West character from the words that surround it. Whereas there are other writers, like, say, Robert Stone, and probably, I would say, myself, where one could seemingly, now, of course, this is a complete illusion, seemingly you could take a character out of the book and he walks through the door, you know, like a Dickens character. Now, we know this is nonsense. Dickens' characters are only assemblages of language. But still, there are some people whose writing seems to be sheer style. Don't you think Paul West is sheer style?
Often, weirdly or interestingly, one of the books he said he'd choose was Gala, which is inspired by his deaf daughter.
Oh, well, then I haven't read that, so that's different.
Yeah,
that would be different.
But it interested me that he was drawn to the books that seem most lifelike.
Most real.
I think Rat Man as well, which seems to have a lot of a lonely man's discovery of a woman who wants to help him. I would imagine, without knowing, that that book has certain of its attraction from feeling that the author knows what it's like to have abandoned himself and to need a certain kind of rescue. I'm not sure about that.
Very interesting. Yes.
I wondered whether, you know, you used to at least write to young writers whose work you read in literary magazines that you liked, and over the years I've met many of them who
have prized you really it. I didn't know I'd done it very many times.
they were delighted. I wondered whether you still do that, or is that something that the encouragement of, and I remember also your writing somewhere about Edmund Wilson, that the idea that he no longer read new fiction, that he didn't encourage young writers. I would imagine that you would remain a discoverer.
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't aware that I'd done it very many times. Maybe each time I do it, I think it's the first time. Well, I'm always reading for literary awards, and I nominate people for pushcart prizes. I'm not aware that they're young writers necessarily. I've been corresponding with a woman writer who turns out she's in her mid-40s, and she's a librarian from Georgia. I really love her work, and we at the Ontario Review Press are going to publish her first book.
What's her name?
Her name is Janice Daugherty, and the title of her book is Going Through the Change, which is significant in a number of ways. But she's a writer who, to me, came literally out of nowhere. She just sent some manuscripts, which I read and liked very much. In fact, I was astonished at how well written they are, line by line by line, beautifully written. So I wasn't aware of doing a lot of that. I'm happy that some people have been encouraged.
It's just that I, how to put this exactly? I sense that in the late 60s and 70s, oddly, your work was sort of the underground.
Yes.
A certain kind of fiction that I think now is too much derided as then it was too much appreciated, was dominant, a kind of academic and very elusive, mm-hmm. Structurally witty fiction. And I kept wondering, I guess, during those years, as much as I liked the work by my teachers, John Barth and Barthelme, who'd been of that school, where were the good books that would mean to me as much as A Tree Grows in Brooklyn had meant to my mother? Mm-hmm, not true. Necessarily a great book, but very, you know, pure in its evocation mm-hmm. of place and time. And I had the feeling that you were drawing the under-the-surface writing, the naturalist, for lack of a better word, because it seems to me that there's no such thing. It's all poetic naturalism. But that you were assembling what would eventually be the balanced picture of American writing.
Well, I certainly have always pursued what I consider psychological realism. And I've admired Barthelme and Barth, but it has never been a kind of writing that's appealed to me. If I had only one day to live, one more day, I would certainly not be reading the metafictionalists. I'd probably be reading Thomas Hardy.
Not Thomas Mann.
Probably I'd be reading Tess of the D'Urbervilles or something like that, that has such a beautiful apprehension of the physical world and people's relationships within it. Almost a mystical appropriation of the human in terms of the natural. Though I love Thomas Mann, but he's much more analytical and ironic.
Well, it's interesting to me that you choose Tess of the D'Urbervilles because it has... It's the only book I think of offhand that has an event that when I remember it without placing it, I think is in one of your books.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking of the plot. I was thinking of the early sections where Tess is the milkmaid and she's described into this very natural world. It's so beautifully written. Of course, novels have plots.
I'm not even thinking of plot. I'm thinking of an image. There's a scene in which blood from a suicide up above comes running down the wall into, I believe, the landlady's apartment. And I always, you know, when I don't quite think, and I remember that scene, I think, that must be in a Joyce Carol Oates book. And then I think, oh, it's in Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
I've completely forgotten it. I'm embarrassed to say you're a better reader of Thomas Hardy than I am. I've forgotten that.
It's an incredible scene.
He has wonderful images, powerful images. And Jude the Obscure, too, is so powerful.
I want to recommend Foxfire by Joyce Carol Oates, recently published by Dutton, and you've already finished your next novel. Will you tell everyone its name?
It's called Corky's Price, and to me it's extremely experimental. It's four last days in the life of a man, completely from his perspective, very much in the vernacular, and very much in the American idiom, something I've never done before, quite like this.
When will it be published?
Well, it won't be published for a very long time, late in 1994. Seems like a long time.
I'll look forward to it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop,
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.